You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
A friend confided in me recently that no matter how many times he hears the theory of relativity and concepts like black holes and string theory explained, it never seems to sink in. Brian Greene has written a book, ostensibly for kids, that also makes those concepts more accessible to people like my friend, and I guess I should admit it to me as well. Professor Greene does it by reimagining the classic myth of Icarus as a space-age short story. It's called Icarus at the Edge of Time. It's published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased that it brings Brian Greene back to the show. Hi.
Hi.
And I should point out also, it's a large format book aimed at kids, or were you thinking that adults might want to read this as well?
I think that's a good description. The primary audience was envisioned as kids, but I think there are others who will just enjoy the story and then be able to dig a little deeper than perhaps a kid would and let the science really inform the way they think about the narrative.
When did you first connect the story of Icarus flying too close to the sun to the notion of space exploration?
Well, when I was a kid and I heard the Icarus myth, it made an impression on me that then later on, as I became a scientist, it began to strike me as a little odd because it's about paying this ultimate penalty for venturing forth into the unknown with curiosity and no inhibitions. And it struck me that to be a scientist, you have to do exactly the opposite. You have to disobey your elders. You have to go for it. And in this version, Icarus doesn't die. He does pay a certain penalty, a painful penalty, but not the penalty of death.
But instead of going too close to the sun, in this case, it's a black hole.
Yes, exactly. So a black hole, you can really think about as a dark star, a star whose light, if you will, can't escape. In fact, that's the way it was thought of hundreds of years ago, before even Einstein brought in the general theory of relativity. And indeed, it is a nice bookend. If the original Icarus was going near the sun, this new 21st century Icarus, if you will, is going near a black hole.
Black holes and space travel have long been inspirations for science fiction, but you call this science in fiction.
Yes, exactly, because at a key moment in this short narrative, the general theory of relativity actually informs how things progress. Now, you don't need to know any general relativity to understand the story, but the idea is a kid who reads a story has these ideas of relativity wash over him or her. I feel it kind of informs the mind, opens the mind up to these wonderful ideas. So in that sense, it's a fictional story with science in it.
Well, I'm sure that most of our listeners have some notion of what a black hole is, but not on the level you or Stephen Hawking might. How much do we need to understand it to grasp the nature of our universe?
Well, black holes are a wonderful laboratory, an astrophysical laboratory that pushes our understanding of the laws of physics to their absolute limit. So right now, the cutting edge of physics, a lot of scientists are trying to understand detailed features of black holes. What happens deep inside a black hole when something gets pulled inside and crushed down at what we call the singularity? What's really going on? This is a puzzle that we're still trying to figure out. So black holes are really a critical feature in our understanding of the universe.
Do we know if the black holes have an opening on the other end?
Some have suggested that. Certainly Einstein and a colleague Rosen a long time ago suggested something called the Einstein-Rosen bridge, in which you might, in some sense, fall into a black hole, go down into the center, and then emerge into another opening, another universe. Most of us can't quite see how this kind of a thing would form in the cosmos, but perhaps.
Well, how do we even know what we know about black holes, since there's none nearby? Isn't it all really speculation?
Yes, and you'd also think if they're black, how would you ever study them out in space? Normally, we study things by the light that they give off, but we've done detailed studies of black holes. For instance, in the center of our galaxy, 26,000 light years away, there's now great evidence that there's a massive black hole there. We know how much it weighs, its mass, 3 million times or so the mass of the sun. We study it because as material falls into the black hole, it heats up because the material gas rubs against itself and creates these bursts of X-ray radiation that we can see as long as the X-rays were emitted before they fell over the edge.
So we can see all the evidence of its activity.
Precisely.
Even if we can't see it per se.
Exactly.
But do we have any idea why they exist and how they're created?
We do. There's a well-known theory of how black holes are formed. If you have a very large star, like a red giant, it supports its massive weight by nuclear processes that generate an outward pressure, heat and pressure that keeps the star from collapsing. But when the star exhausts its nuclear fuel, that outward force goes away. The star collapses. It heats up. It blows out its outer surface, leaves a little neutron star, and if that's heavy enough, it collapses to form a black hole.
So we know how they're created, but do they serve a function in space other than to gobble up other things?
We see evidence of black holes not only in the center of our galaxy, but in the centers of many, many galaxies. So it does seem that black holes may be, if you will, the engine of galaxies, the critical seed around which galaxies form and evolve. So yes, they play a critical role.
You've argued that science education in America misses the bigger picture. What's missing in science classes nowadays?
Well, I think a lot of kids think of science merely as a subject in the classroom, as material that is in a textbook. And I think it's so critical that kids see science as a way of life, as an exciting adventure story, as this drama, as we've tried to understand the universe. And the point of this book really is to show another side of science.
The side that's a bit more human, because science is taught as something that's rather cold and rigid.
That's right. We quickly focus in on getting kids to solve equations, balance reactions, know parts of cells, all that sort of stuff, which is important. But if you don't have that emotional content, if you don't have that emotional connection, science feels cold and aloof. And the point of this story is just to try to have someone experience science in a more visceral, more emotional way, as opposed to just trying to understand the facts.
My guest is Brian Greene, who's done television, done all sorts of other things, and works as a physicist. His latest book is called Icarus at the Edge of Time, published by Knopf, and it's illustrated with photographs from the Hubble Space Telescope. You could have used drawings, couldn't you? What is gained by using real pictures, pictures that often look like abstract expressionist paintings but may require a bit more to really understand?
Well, the designer was this really wonderful
Chip Kidd,
who's just fantastic. And the one thing that we decided early on was that a real literal interpretation of the story wasn't what we were after. We wanted to create the atmosphere of space, the atmosphere of being near a black hole, rather than trying to just mirror the story in visuals. And I think the graphic element that he put in there is quite wondrous. It's very subtle, it's very simple, but it gives you this real powerful sense of going toward a black hole and going away from it, in the wonderful context of a beautiful space environment.
And you also try to make some of the story funny.
Yeah.
To engage the kids.
Sure, absolutely.
But wouldn't the kids who be attracted to this, most attracted to this, be the kind of geeky kids who are attracted to science in general? I'm assuming you were one of those kids.
I think I probably was, and I think the story would definitely appeal to kids of that sort. But I've had anecdotal evidence, of course, of people I've given the story, have read it to their kids who aren't necessarily heading in a science direction, who just sort of love it as an adventure story, this unusual story heading out to a black hole. And they don't have to take in the underlying science, but they can if they so choose to. And later on, I suspect, if they revisit the story, they would.
The book posits the possibility that black holes might someday allow for a type of time travel.
That's right. We learn from Einstein that a kind of time travel is actually built in to the laws of physics. It's a time travel to the future. So without giving away the ending of the story too much, an element of that does play a part here. If you spend time near a black hole, when you return, you will return to a future time.
And the big problem would be that if you came too close to a black hole, you could also be killed by it.
Well, absolutely. So if you cross over what we call the event horizon of a black hole, it's a point of no return. Once you go beyond that point, it is impossible to get out, and your fate is sealed. But if you stay near the edge and are careful not to cross over, you can survive.
Even though the story is about a black hole, the narrative also focuses on families. And on top of science, I'm assuming you were trying to convince kids, maybe your own kids, that their parents might actually know a thing or two.
That's right. Well, it's an interesting tension, and I think it plays out both in the original Icarus story and this one, that yes, you do need to listen to the wisdom of your elders to an extent, but ultimately I think the story highlights the fact that you need to follow your passion, you need to follow what excites you, and if that requires that you go against what your parents suggest, so be it. There may be a painful outcome associated with that, but sometimes that pain is worth it.
The women on my staff wondered why there are no females in the book.
It's a good question, and I really decided that I was going to follow this progression of fathers and sons in this setup with a ship heading out to a distant star with multi-generations on board. And it really was just a personal choice that this kind of link between fathers and sons, as it plays out in the original story, would be played out here in the same way.
Now, you are both a working scientist and a popularizer of scientific ideas. Does one take up too much of your time?
Well, it's always a delicate balance, which I struggle with all the time, because if you spend time doing one thing, you're doing less than something else, of course. I have found, however, in a way that works well, sometimes the popularization of the science don't cause attention, but they go hand in hand. I have found certain research problems really brought to my attention by virtue of thinking about how to bring some idea of science to a general audience. And when that happens, it really feels like it's all working together.
Because this is the biggest problem. It's finding a way to make these ideas accessible to everybody. And sometimes it's very difficult because when you're working on a very high level in physics, you're working with math, and that's where my eyes suddenly glaze over.
Sure, but let me make one point there. When I'm doing my work, which is highly mathematical, I never feel satisfied if I only understand it from the mathematical equations. I always try to build a mental picture of what's going on. And then when I speak to general audiences or write a general audience book, I focus on those images, those pictures, strip away the details that aren't necessary to communicate. And in that way, the work and the research and bringing the ideas to a general audience really go hand in hand.
Did you have your son read this book to make sure that he understood everything?
I did. Now, he's a little bit young. He was three. He's now three and a half when I was first
played it. He's not going to know too much.
So he liked it as a story, but I have to say he inspired the story because I was telling him my own little, perhaps over-the-top bedtime stories a while back, talking about ships going near the speed of light. And he turned to me, I didn't know if he was getting it, but he turned to me and said, "The speed of light? What about the speed of dark?" And at that moment, it just sort of struck me how that's an interesting idea and how narrative and storytelling can really get the creative juices flowing even in a field like physics.
And that actually in some ways reminds me that my next guest is Frank Wilczek, who's talked an awful lot about the dark.
Sure.
In the cosmos. We'll be talking a bit about string theory with him, but you have been a key figure in the development of string theory, which is still up in the air.
Sure.
Are you sure that ultimately string theory will all work out?
Oh, God, no. Absolutely not. The only thing that I'm ever sure about is the way you make a decision is based upon data and experiments. I would say that as of today, string theory is our best approach to putting together general relativity and quantum mechanics into what we call a unified theory. But do I know it's right? No. Do I believe it's right? No. Do I think it's the best approach we have on the table? Yes, I do. And we'll let data be the ultimate decider.
Because there have been complaints in the scientific community that most of the best minds in physics today have been involved in the pursuit of coming up with a final string theory, and maybe it's all just a wild goose chase.
I know, but if they are so-called the best minds, you have to trust their intuition that this is something worthwhile to work on. So, you know, I think there's a reason why string theory has the pull that it does.
What's your next project? Are you going back to television? You're going to do a book for adults again?
Well, I do have a book for adults in the works. We actually do have a television series also we're thinking about, but the real focus right now is I'm trying to understand cosmology according to string theory, so that's the real scientific pursuit.
But I suspect that there'll be some adults who will sneak a reading of this book because it really does explain things in a way that we all can understand. And the book is Icarus at the Edge of Time, published by Knopp, and with incredible images because those Hubble pictures are, we never had anything like them before. And they're all astounding. I guess the dye job does help, right? I mean, these are black and white pictures that we dye?
Oh, no, they actually are color images where the color is shifted into the frequencies that our eyes can sense. So there is
different
science
colors
behind those colors.
But there are different colors if I were up there?
Not that your eyes would see exactly as in those pictures, but there is science associated with how those colors are chosen to represent the different things that are out there in space.
Thank you so much for being with us again.
My pleasure.
Thank you.